It's normal for me to thank guests, but I know you've got a million things to do, and you guys reached out to us to make sure that you included us on this trip. So thank you.
Larry, I'm always glad to stop by. I try to do it whenever I'm in Ferndale, and I try to get to Ferndale as often as I can. So this is great.
You were here extensively, like you were doing something in Ferndale earlier, right?
Yeah, I had some meeting with some agricultural leaders just now to talk about the drought and some other issues.
I wanted to talk about one thing that I saw this come by a little while ago. This is the Plant Act that I want to talk about. And this is legislation that you introduced to deal with sort of trespass marijuana grows on public lands. And I know that you're meeting with some law enforcement people tomorrow, I believe, to talk about this. And what struck me when I first saw, you know, this press release come across was, obviously, this is something that most people can get behind. We recognize that there are problems in this area, and it is a problem that needs to be addressed. But my thought was, well, how is this different from the existing laws? I mean, it's already illegal to grow marijuana. And it's illegal to trespass on public lands and do these things. So how does the legislation proposed change that or enhance it?
It's really a penalty enhancement where, and it's not even so much the marijuana that we're focusing on, marijuana is part of it, but it's the illegal trespass piece and the environmental damage piece. So what we've done in this bill is direct the Sentencing Commission to substantially increase penalties when you have a trespass marijuana grow that has a number of elements to it: illegal water diversions, cutting of trees, destruction of wildlife, use of toxics. So we're trying to get at the problem of the terrible environmental damage from these trespass grows that is so well documented and well known here and elsewhere around the West.
Does additional sort of penalties on top of something that's already illegal, does that really stop someone from doing it? I mean, if I'm going to go on public land and set up a meth lab, I already know it's illegal, and I probably am not going to be dissuaded knowing there's some additional penalty.
Well, it probably won't stop every incident, but I think it will help, and I think together with an increased focus from law enforcement, that's part of why I'm meeting with some law enforcement leaders tomorrow morning. Increased cooperation from district attorneys in pursuing the water theft and other type of charges that can be part of this, especially going into a critical drought year like this. I guess my feeling is, you know, no, this is not the silver bullet that makes trespass grows go away, but we're going to need every tool that we can brought to bear, again, while we work on more coherent marijuana policy in the bigger picture, which I think has to include decriminalization.
Okay. Well, that was another.
This is not the silver bullet. This is, I think, a piece of the problem that is really acute right now, especially for our fisheries and our watersheds. We got to do more to protect them. This is part of that. But the real long-term solution is really built around decriminalization.
And that is long-term, really, because there's
may not be so long-term. I think it's one of these issues where the landscape is shifting before our eyes as we watch what's happened in Colorado and Washington, as I watch my own colleagues casting votes that they never would have cast a few years ago. I mean, we have basically taken away the federal prohibition on industrial hemp in this Congress. That was a step that no prior Congress had been willing to do, and it's bipartisan. We just a few weeks ago passed a bipartisan amendment that defers to states on medical cannabis and lets the VA doctors. We didn't quite pass that. We came very close to passing one that would let the VA actually advise patients about medical cannabis. We'll keep working on that.
Just from watching Bill O'Reilly, I formed the opinion that legalization of marijuana has become caught up in the larger sort of cultural war. He goes on and on about Colorado and these crazy liberals out there. But
it's not that simple.
I mean, is that a sentiment on the Hill, though?
I think he's wrong about that. There may be some cultural warriors on this issue, but I have allies on this issue that are fierce Tea Party libertarians from the Deep South. And so it's very cross-cutting. There still are elements to the cultural war, but this issue is getting... is evolving pretty rapidly.
Okay. I want to ask you a question about another piece of legislation that you just introduced, the Stop Corporate Expatriation and Interest in and Invest in America. Let me do this again.
It's a mouthful.
I'll edit this part out. The Stop Corporate Expatriation and Invest in America's Infrastructure Act, which I'm very disappointed there's not a catchy little
It's acronym. Not much of an acronym, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Slavic.
So what is this all about?
What this is about is the fact that our federal transportation infrastructure funding is in real trouble. We've got a structural deficit of many billions of dollars every year because the gas tax, which was set at about 18 cents in 1993, has not been increased or indexed to inflation. So we got a bigger country, we've got a lot more transportation infrastructure, and we have not had increased funding. In fact, we've gone the other way with greater fuel efficiency. So every year we have to backfill, and that's why, you know, about this time of year, every year, you see lots of talk about, will Congress, you know, come up with a stopgap to keep our transportation projects from shutting down. We're doing it again this summer. And what this bill does is it looks for a longer term fix. And the piece that this bill looks at is kind of playing out right now. There's a major pharmaceutical acquisition going on that you may have read about, where an American pharmaceutical company is purchasing a European company and planning to deduct the costs of moving operations overseas, because our tax laws currently let them do that, and then renounce U.S. Citizenship as its headquarters, claim the other country's headquarters for tax purposes, and then never repatriate the income that the company generates thereafter. We got to close those loopholes. And that's what this bill would do. It would use that revenue to plug the hole in our highway trust fund and reinvest in American transportation infrastructure.
The press release that accompanies the announcement of this legislation talks about the potential for raising $19.5 billion in revenue over 10 years. My understanding was that this was a much, much larger practice. Tech companies do this all the time. They set up a subsidiary in Ireland, and then their headquarters is officially in Corfu or something like that, and thus they avoid paying American taxes. So does this legislation attempt to go after all of that? Or
yes.
Is it? Okay. Yeah. And that's the figure, $19.5 billion?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
And it doesn't... We're going to need more than that to fully fund our transportation infrastructure needs, but that's a big piece of it. And, you know, we'll look at other solutions too. There's lots of ideas bouncing around Washington right now, some short-term, some longer-term. I happen to believe we should replace the gas tax with a carbon tax that would look at all transportation fuels and look at the carbon intensity of them. I'm going to put that forward in some legislation in the weeks ahead. But, you know, one way or the other, we have to address this. You can't every year come up short and then scramble, you know, in a dysfunctional Congress to try to avoid a crisis.
All right. One of the core functions that most people think the government has is taking care of the roads. I saw that there was a proposal to increase the gas tax coming from the other side of the aisle, which I was a little surprised about. But it seems like it's
unlikely a phased in.
To pass.
Well, you know, none of these things are easy politically. But yeah, there is a proposal with some bipartisan, very unusual bedfellows. It has Rand Paul together with, I believe, Ron Wyden from Oregon, and they're proposing a several-year phase-in of a gas tax increase. So, you know, you have some ideas on the table that can help. And hopefully some political will to get it done.
Okay. One more question about stuff that relates to locally, and then I wanted to get to D.C., and I know the clock is ticking. So you were sent a letter not too long ago from insurance people about the situation with Blue Cross. This was a cover story in the North Coast Journal not too long ago.
Right.
And basically, when I signed up for Obamacare, there was a long list of providers that were included, and I based my decision to choose this healthcare plan on the fact that my doctor was included and a lot of other ones were included as well. As the plot thickened, it turned out that a lot of those people who were listed on the list aren't actually in the network, and there's higher costs for out-of-network providers. And it seems a little tough to believe that this was just something that got messed up at Blue Cross. It seems intentional. And I know people sent you a letter, and I was just wondering if you had an update on that.
Well, people sent me a letter, and what you experienced, Larry, you're a poster child for something that's happening all over the North Coast, unfortunately. You're right. Blue Cross put out a wildly inaccurate list of providers. People went out on the exchange and bought their plan in reliance on that, and then somewhere along the line they said, oops, this is inaccurate. Turns out they had almost none of the providers in the area under contract. So they pulled it off, and there has been no list put back up, but the problem is people like you who bought their plans relying on that list, and then many of them came to realize when they got sick, needed to see a doctor or a specialist, that they really had paper insurance. It didn't mean a lot to them without access. So yeah, I got the letter, and we went I hadn't had a meeting with some of the insurance brokers that have been representing clients and buying these policies. They were getting the blowback from their clients who were outraged, justifiably. And my staff and I went to work to try to get some accountability for this. We wrote a letter to Covered California. We copied it to the Department of Managed Healthcare, DMHC, which is, you know, one of the watchdog agencies in Sacramento, about the network inadequacy problem. And the North Coast Journal did a terrific job, by the way, in that article, I think, on a very complex subject, explaining, you know, why this is such a big deal. So the good news is DMHC apparently listened and has begun an investigation of Anthem Blue Cross. And that's what we were hoping for. That should help this. Now, Anthem was already starting to feel some of the pressure and entering into contracts and beginning to broaden its network. But this DMHC action, I think, is going to be really significant in moving them to do the right thing. And my hope is that in a matter of weeks and hopefully not months, we will see the kind of network where you can see the doctor you need to see.
It seems like the solution to this, at least in the short term, is for Anthem Blue Cross to put out an accurate list of providers. So if that accurate list of providers is presumably a lot smaller than the bogus one,
yeah,
at least we're getting the truth and we know what we're getting into when we sign up with it. But it doesn't do anything to solve this sort of larger problem, which is probably the case in a lot of rural areas where just access to healthcare is difficult because you have a small number of providers and right. a large number of customers.
Well, and we need more competition because here in Humboldt, Anthem Blue Cross, I think, is 90% of the market. Yeah. So this would be a great example of where a public option would have been terrific, would have given consumers another choice. It would have given that competitive benefit that maybe brought Anthem Blue Cross to, you know, inspired them to build out a network and price things better. But we don't have that, so we've just got to keep pushing. The health clinics are benefiting tremendously by this, and you know, while we work through the network problems, you know, the Open Door Clinic and other clinics are always there to see folks, but I'm not going to be satisfied until we get this network problem addressed, and I hope in the next round that we will see more competition here in Humboldt County, that we'll see other carriers bid into the exchange and bring some real competition to Blue Cross.
Yeah, I hope so, and maybe someday a public option. Yeah. Okay, more sort of general political stuff from D.C. I want you to, if you were willing to, put on your prognosticator hat, and what do you anticipate as a result of the midterms?
I don't think this is going to be a wave election. You know, wave elections are where huge number of seats turn over. All the indications are that this is going to be a very close election. I think the generic congressional ballot has Democrats up nationally 1.5 points. What that generally means, since Democrats don't turn out as well as Republicans, is that we're basically at a draw. Republicans may pick up a few seats in the House. Democrats may pick up a few, but it won't be a seat change. I think the same thing more or less is going to happen in the Senate, but the difference there is that Democrats are defending more seats just by virtue of how this particular election cycle plays out. So the Democrats may lose a few seats in the Senate. I don't think they'll lose all six, I believe, or seven it would be necessary to lose the Senate. But I think the margins will tighten there. And so we're going to be looking at the final 2 years of this president, I think, with more or less the same situation as we've seen for the last two. And at some point, people are going to have to decide, you know, people in Congress are going to have to decide, do they continue trying to blame President Obama for everything and doing nothing for the American people? Or is it maybe time to work cooperatively and try to get some things done?
Well, that leads in nicely into my next question, because it is an embarrassing tactic for the Republicans to use, but also it does seem to be somewhat productive for them to just not let anything go through. And there's no real reason to think that that's going to change. Obama very recently, in the context of the immigration debate, yeah, announced an intention to start using executive orders, basically saying, if Congress isn't going to act, then I am going to, because we can't let these things just sit. And I have a couple of questions about that. I wonder what your feeling is of the executive making use of his executive authorities and bypassing Congress.
Well, you know, I would much prefer that we actually legislate in Congress. This is the least productive Congress if you measure it by, you know, the number of bills passed into law in American history. And that's a terrible statement. We've got to change that. We've got to start getting things done. But, you know, what does it say about the desire for obstruction and strangling government effectiveness if after failing to get anything done, Speaker Boehner and his majority in the House are now suing the president to stop him from at least trying to use his executive authority to get some things done? This is a very negative agenda for our country to just not allow governing to happen. I prefer the normal deliberative process where bills happen, hearings happen, votes happen. But unfortunately, the obstructionists, especially in the House, have just refused to do that. So I'm sympathetic to the president. I don't like vast expansions of executive power. I think we need accountability. And Congress, when it's working, is an important part of providing that accountability. But these are uncharted waters where you've got a governing majority in the House of Representatives that just refuses to govern.
I mean, and I know it's mostly a ploy, but it's sort of a bizarre thing to have the Speaker of the House suing the president. Do you think that the expanded use of executive orders would withstand legal scrutiny?
Yeah, I think they will. And in fact, I think the use of executive authority has been grossly exaggerated. Example of the national monuments and marine sanctuaries and things, which, you know, presidents since the time of Teddy Roosevelt have had the authority to do. President Obama has done it less than many of his predecessors. But every time he does do it, you know, the folks on Fox News light their hair on fire and start screaming about executive overreach. And so the PR machine right now, in a very partisan way, is doing everything possible to accuse this president of overreach. It's not really all that true if you break it down and look at prior administrations and what they've done.
Right. Well, a lot of the things don't stand up if you look at them closely. But again, it's a tactic that seems to be working. Witness the recent election in Virginia, and now Kevin McCarthy is coming in place of Cantor. Do you know him? Had you worked with him in the Assembly?
Kevin McCarthy?
Yeah.
No, we did not overlap. He left before I got there. But he was well regarded by colleagues across the aisle. I think he's seen by people in both parties now as a nice guy, an approachable guy, an institutionalist, and not a radical ideologue. He's going to be challenged in the weeks ahead, though, on one particular issue, because he's had a position opposing the reauthorization of the Export-Import Bank. And that is coming to a head in the next few weeks. What that does is that actually uses public money to create demand for U.S. products abroad so that it supports our exporting, not just manufacturers, but agriculture, you know, lots of things that we export. It's a big deal for the business community, including small businesses. And if we let it go, you know, that's going to be a blow to our economic recovery. But McCarthy and some other Republicans believe that's another government program that should be taken over by the private sector. The private sector doesn't necessarily agree with them. The Chamber of Commerce and others would like to see this program reauthorized. And so this will be an important test, I think, of McCarthy as the new majority leader.
He has made some noises in the press, at least, about being against the reauthorization of the Ex-Im Bank, and also has sort of changed a little bit his opinion on immigration policy. And I'm wondering if somebody, particularly in that position, necessarily pulled to the right, particularly given the circumstances of him getting that position.
He has to be, because his caucus consists of very, very conservative folks, you know, seated in these deep red districts in the South. And so he's going to have to take positions and make decisions that in some cases are going to be at odds with his own California district.
All right. Well, we'll it's always interesting, if not frequently frustrating, to watch what happens in Washington. We really appreciate you coming down.
Great to be with you.
I know you're on your way to the ballpark, but you're not throwing out the first ball as you had planned.
I was all excited to throw out the first pitch at the Crabs game, but I have my right arm in a sling.
What happened?
Because I have a separated shoulder. I was preparing for the congressional baseball game last week and took a tumble in the infield and separated the shoulder. So unless they let me throw in kind of a gimpy left-handed way tonight, I'll just be a spectator.
All right. Well, it's always a good time at the Crabs game. Thanks again for coming by.
Thanks, Larry.